This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a Philadelphia judge has supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal worried. Canadians of Caribbean descent organize for political solidarity. And is the U.S. trying to depopulate its island colony of Puerto Rico?
But first, a question of religion and Black radicalism. Dr. Vincent Lloyd is a professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University. Dr. Lloyd wrote a recent article for Black Agenda Report in which he maintained that Black American religion is rooted in radicalism, exemplified by leaders such as Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. Lloyd said what he calls secularism means being caught up in the world as it is, not as it should be.
I think it's really important to access the theological imagination at its best, which is when it allows us to think beyond the world, think beyond the ways that political issues are framed by politicians of the day, when the theological imagination gives us an opportunity to reframe the conversation in the service of justice. And I think too often preachers who are coming from and speaking to sort of middle-class congregations are caught up in the values and ways of living that those congregations embrace, that the individuals in those congregations are part of, rather than challenging them, rather than inviting them to think otherwise, to think what it might be to advocate for positions that are radically different from, you know, what's on the table being discussed in Washington or in the State House today.
You point out very correctly that most Black churches sat out the civil rights movement. In fact, if we look at Dr. King's itinerary, his travels across the South, they appear to be defined by those cities, the minority of in which Black congregations let him in, and the larger number of Black congregations that did not.
Yes, even within his own Baptist denomination, King struggled to achieve a broad support for civil rights movement. I think today, when we look back on civil disobedience as such a laudable sort of practice and one that can be fueled by religious traditions and theological imagination, you know, at the time it was very controversial and seen by many religious communities, many Black Christian churches, as just lawbreaking, just something that should be condemned, something that went against religious teachings. So I think when we're remembering civil disobedience and most progressive elements of the civil rights movement, we need to remember that they were really not reflective of Christianity as a whole at the moment, but rather of the most prophetic elements of Christianity, and we should be looking for those prophetic elements today to build alliances with.
On the other side of the spectrum, you see a kind of Black religiosity in Huey Newton, who would certainly have described himself as a scientific socialist.
Yes, a formation like that of Eldridge Cleaver and George Jackson, all of whom were educated in religious settings to some extent, and that, you know, I don't think we can forget that sort of religious formation when we're looking at their politics, even when those politics are expressed in secular terms. And I think that opens up the possibility for alliances between those on the secular left and prophetic religious communities that want to think beyond the terms of the world, think what it would mean to live in communities that look radically different than our communities do today, and allow religious communities to be inspired by the Panther or by radical elements of the civil rights movement, seeing them as voices that resonate with Christian voices rather than that are in opposition to Christian voices.
But a materialist, a scientific socialist, would surely consider himself or herself to be secular
and might take offense that, in your assessment, they're accepting the choices on the table, a table that's set by the ruling class. They would say, no, we don't accept those choices, but we are secular.
If one looks at the writings and iconography around Huey Newton, just to take an example, right, the language of religion and particularly Christianity is all over it, right? There are these parables that Newton tells to those around him. There are these identifications with Jesus and Christian figures. There are calls for revolutionary love and, I mean, even revolutionary suicide. If you think about it, the title of his book has such deep resonances with religious traditions. So I think just the label of materialism or scientific socialism doesn't have to lead to a sort of incompatibility with Christian imagination. I think that most prophetic voices from the Christian theological tradition look very carefully at the material conditions, right? You can only speak prophetically once you appreciate the specificity of the material conditions in a specific context. To challenge those conditions, you need to know those conditions. And to be able to offer a vision that's radically different, you need to know from what that is different.
I want to quote directly from Huey Newton's Revolutionary Suicide. We were compelled to read it when I was in the party. And Huey Newton wrote, "I have no other God but man, and I firmly believe that man is the highest or chief good." You consider this a religious statement?
Well, if one thinks about Christian traditions that see God in man, right, the image of God in the soul of a human being, the very highest value that a Christian, say, could find, the source of all things, the ultimate ground of being, right, God is in the soul of man. The place to look for it is in the soul of the human being. So, I mean, I think these sorts of ways in which Newton is holding up the human being are not on the surface incompatible. And of course, it's really the practices that matter rather than the labels that matter. And if one looks at the extent to which Black churches were involved in providing the infrastructure for breakfast programs, the extent to which the Panthers in Oakland were trying to build church-like organizations, even if they're called Temples to Humanity, and they meet on Sundays and they have church-like practices and education programs happening on a Sunday morning, those resonances seem like they ought to be appreciated and ought to make possible alliances moving forward.
In terms of Malcolm X, you say in your recent article for Black Agenda Report, "Black religion at its best for Malcolm is religion of the field Negro." What is the religion of the field Negro?
Yes, I want to encourage us to think about Malcolm X not as a Muslim leader or as a secular leader, but as a Black political leader who has a radical religious imagination, who is encouraging us to set aside our investments in the ways that things have been done in the world, in politics, in terms of social issues, and in terms of community organization. Malcolm's great contribution is to call out those of his contemporaries, including Dr. King, when they were too invested in the powers that be, when they were not just necessarily taking money, but being formed by their associations with middle-class Black and white establishment figures and institutions, seeing how those associations can contaminate political imagination and bring it back down to the level of fixing this policy or that policy, and not lifting it up to imagining what a world dramatically more just, transformed from the roots, would look like.
Since 1954, the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States, which is mandatory in some arenas, has included the words, "In God we trust." What kind of religion is that reflective of?
That's reflective of a religion wholly identified with the nation state, with the powers that be. This is one of the great challenges with the language and practices of any religious community, that on the one hand, they have the possibility to lift individuals and communities up to make possible what was previously thought impossible, but they also have the possibility to just legitimize those with power already, to just offer a kind of warm coating to those who are causing oppression and those who are benefiting from oppression. And so I think that the sort of care that needs to be taken in distinguishing the religion of the house Negro from the religion of the field Negro, as Malcolm X might say, is great. One needs to not just dismiss, not just accept, but think critically and carefully and appreciate the complexities of religious traditions and the need to appreciate careful political analysis as well. And study, political study as well as religious study, should go together in being able to make those distinctions.
And how would you characterize the religion of folks like Jerry Falwell and his cohorts?
Yes, I'm not sure if some of those beliefs and professions even qualify for religion, in the sense that what one is doing is only taking the fears and anxieties of a culture and naming them with labels that come from religious histories or traditions. That's just doing something that's really the opposite of religious. That's demonic, in a sense, if one wants to use that sort of religious vocabulary. Just seeing how racial anxieties, gender anxiety, sexuality anxieties are circulating at a particular moment in time in a particular culture, and capitalizing on those for one's own sort of political advancement doesn't seem to have much to do with religion at all, from my point of view.
And what about that personage who my grandmother sent lots of money to, Reverend Ike?
Yes, in many cases there are equivocations and ambiguities, and I'm not one to pronounce hard judgments on complicated individuals in difficult circumstances, particularly when they're coming from especially marginalized sorts of backgrounds. So Reverend Ike and others are reminders of the kind of political and religious study that's necessary on the individual and sort of small group community level in order to build the capacity for discernment when encountering such figures.
What do you think the state of liberation theology is in Black America?
I think there was an unfortunate institutionalization in the academy of the prophetic impulses of many strands of liberation theology, a reduction of the political impulses behind liberation theology into cultural impulses to appreciate the diversity of American and international cultures and to bring every voice to the table, the sort of neoliberal multiculturalism that contaminates discussions around diversity in secular spheres as well. But of course, at the same time, on the grassroots level and in some institutional contexts, there are and have been prophetic voices that are learning from the experiences of those marginalized, whether they're for reasons of sexuality or class, and of course, race as well, and the intersection of these sorts of forms of marginalization. I think liberation theology at its best, you know, happens when it is a dialogue between the sort of conceptual analysis that can happen and political study that can happen in academic and intellectual spaces, and those experiences of intersecting marginalizations and struggle, community organizing struggle at the grassroots. But all too often, those sorts of dialogues between the grassroots and the intellectual don't happen.
Dr. Cornel West calls himself a Christian revolutionary. How do you feel about that terminology?
Yes, I admire Cornel West's activism and thought very much. And I mean, I think what is exciting about the way that West presents himself is that it creates openings for those on the left and those in Christian communities to see their common concerns, to see that there are conversations that can be had. There's organizing that can happen together across the secular religious divide. So the more public figures who can use that kind of language to identify themselves, I think the more possibilities for coalitional organizing are made possible.
And you note that Malcolm X recommended old-time religion. What is old-time religion, and do we need some more of it?
Malcolm X can be read in different ways there. He can be read as just nostalgic for some time long ago of his grandparents or great-grandparents when life wasn't so complicated. But I think that the better way to read Malcolm X there is not as nostalgic, but rather as calling us to attend to the religion that exists at the grassroots in marginalized communities, where the experiences of marginalization make it so clear that ideology is contaminating how we live our lives and how we see the world. The wealthy and the powerful are advancing their own agendas, even if they're using Black community leaders to advance those agendas, that we need to be suspicious of those who are coming from middle class and elite backgrounds and trying to say what politics or religion ought to be. I think Malcolm X is, you know, reminding us of those people we know in our communities, whether they're our grandparents or cousins or neighbors or community elders whose lives have been shaped in such a way that they have wisdom to share with us that can help us in this discernment of that's both religious and political, a discernment that makes us suspicious of the ways of the world and that attunes us to possibilities to live and imagine otherwise.
That was Dr. Vincent Lloyd, professor of theology and religious study at Villanova University.
Donald Trump is almost certainly the most disliked man in Puerto Rico. Trump's insulting remarks in the wake of Hurricane Irma cut deep into Puerto Rican pride. The U.S. colony has lost 10% of its population in the last decade due to U.S. economic policies. Some folks believe that the real goal of U.S. policy is to depopulate the island. We spoke with Kevin Cashman of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
I think that's definitely an angle that holds some water. We've been seeing Puerto Rico neglected by the federal government, not wanting to spend the money, not wanting to change the political status of the island. And also, you can see that neglect in a couple different ways. One is not wanting to spend the money. The other is furthering this colonial project, which has defined the U.S.'s occupation in Puerto Rico.
You at the Center for Economic and Policy Research say that Puerto Rico needs a whole new economic plan if it's going to stand a chance to recover. But Puerto Rico is a colony. It can't put in effect its own plan if it has one.
That's exactly right. PROMESA, which is the bill that provided some relief from creditors, is imposed on Puerto Rico and actually took control of most of the operations on the island. They have a lot of the final say of monetary policy and fiscal policy, I should say. And that really constrains what Puerto Rico can do to help itself to begin with. And then also you just have its political status, which is also constraining in the first place. And that political status was a big part of why Puerto Rico is in this mess to begin with.
Puerto Rico, of course, is politically a colony of the United States, but its debt is not to the United States. It's to these financial institutions and amounts to something around $74 billion. President Trump made noises recently about relieving that debt, but can a president do that?
I would take his words with lots of grains of salt. It seems that he really wants to please people. He had been getting a lot of flack from people on the island, and he said that, but based on other things he said, we don't have much confidence that, or at least I don't have much confidence that he will follow through with that, especially when his administration and a lot of his friends are tied to financial institutions or know people who do hold Puerto Rican debt. And you're also right that there isn't a mechanism right now that would eliminate that debt. You would have to have action from Congress, or you would have to have major change in the Federal Reserve's policy in order to have that sort of debt relief.
But at any rate, the Puerto Ricans have said long before this hurricane that the debt cannot be paid. So what happens?
I think that PROMESA is a vehicle that could reduce some of its debt. I'm not sure that it will actually, in fact, do that. You know, right now, community institutions on the island and political groups need to put pressure on the president, Congress, and the people that are on the PROMESA board to either change the PROMESA process so that there is significant debt relief that puts the island on a path to growth and that puts its citizens at the forefront of this process and their needs and welfare, or they need to come up with a new plan that either wipes out the debt or returns control back to the island so that they can start to make economic decisions that will grow the economy.
President Trump early on said some disrespectful things about Puerto Rico, as if the Puerto Ricans had brought this problem on themselves. But it was the Obama administration that appointed this oversight board that imposed this draconian austerity plan on Puerto Rico.
That's correct, and Obama had a large part to play and also who is on this board. And, you know, just looking at the board, you see people who, some don't have ties to the Puerto Rican community, others have ties to the financial industry. There's a very conservative scholar on the board that advocates for cutting Social Security here in the United States. So PROMESA definitely gave the island relief from creditors' immediate demands, but it didn't really set up the island to any sort of path out of the crisis. And Obama is responsible in large part for that.
Your center also writes that if there is continued austerity, the island will become even more vulnerable to the hurricanes that are bound to sweep through again.
That's also right. If the economy doesn't recover, the island will continue to lose population, which erodes its economic base. It won't be able to deal with natural disasters. We just released a new paper on Medicaid, and Puerto Rico's Medicaid program is essential to the island's residents, but it's also not funded on par with what it would be if Puerto Rico was a state. So Puerto Rico gets significantly less money from the federal government for this important program, and in a couple years, it won't be able to pay for the program at all. And this is the most important health program on the island.
As an independent nation, Puerto Rico could renounce the debt, but as a state, not necessarily.
As a state, Puerto Rico would probably have to deal with the debt in some sort of way, either as a condition as its admission or just because there wouldn't be enough political will to go through with the debt reduction package that I've been talking about. If it were an independent island, that would be a much harder path, at least initially to begin with. But, you know, Puerto Ricans could seek help from other places in order to deal with the debt. It also could try to get some of the debt off its books as an independent nation.
Yes, Puerto Rico is quite near to Cuba and was in need of Cuba's excellent healthcare expeditionary services, but couldn't avail itself of them.
That's right. The Jones Act prevents foreign flagged vessels from stopping on the island and then continuing on to the U.S. So, in effect, that means that a lot of ships and will decide to just bypass the island because they don't want to leave out the larger market of the U.S. And that has hampered recovery efforts. Venezuela and Cuba both, I think, had opposition because of that act to relief efforts. And then there's also those countries politically would like to help and show solidarity with Puerto Rico, but those are also two countries that the U.S. does not have particularly good relations with.
So the Jones Act actually sets up a kind of blockade in reverse for Puerto Rico.
I wouldn't say it's a blockade as such, but the Jones Act applies to the entire country, but places like Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, which has an exemption from it, and Hawaii are particularly affected by it because of the dynamic with ships not stopping there. So in a sense, it does prevent a lot of supplies from getting to the island unless Puerto Ricans want to pay a hefty price because a lot of those goods would need to be shipped to the mainland and then shipped back to Puerto Rico.
So a ship would, for example, have to stop in New Orleans before doubling back to Puerto Rico.
That's correct. And then if that was a foreign flag vessel, if it did land in Puerto Rico, I think that it would be barred from stopping in the mainland. But that's if it was a foreign flag vessel. But a foreign flag vessel landing in New Orleans would unload its goods, and then a U.S. ship would carry that to Puerto Rico. So that's what the Jones Act requires.
Do the people that the center speaks with in Puerto Rico get the sense that folks on the island are having a serious rethinking of their relationship with the United States?
I think that Trump especially has galvanized that sort of thinking because his initial response to this island, to this crisis, and the lack of basic services of about 3 million people, over 3 million people, was to talk about stuff going on in the NFL. He didn't even mention what was going on the island for a few days. And this is the person that is supposed to be coordinating and ensuring that relief efforts are happening. And he was completely negligent in that job.
Yes, and got into a hissy fit with the mayor of San Juan.
That's right. And she was trying to ask him for help. And because she was not doing it in a way that I guess he liked, he started that fight with her.
That was Kevin Cashman of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
The Caribbean region has been battered by both global warming and neo-colonial political relationships. Renaco Gregg is a co-founder of the Canada-based Caribbean Solidarity Network. He spoke to us from Toronto.
The Caribbean is really at the forefront of the implications of climate change. So there's a lot of talk about climate change and what needs to be done and lowering emissions and all the toxic elements that are pushing toward the increase in global temperature that leads to these sort of natural disasters that we see that are happening with more frequency and more intensity. The Caribbean is, despite the fact that they are not responsible in any significant way for these elements of climate change or global warming, they end up bearing the brunt of the symptoms of climate change. And so we have a situation where you can have Barbuda, which is part of Antigua and Barbuda, a whole island that had to be evacuated. You have Dominica, a population of close to 60,000 people, where they had 90% of their buildings destroyed. So these are serious implications. And of course, Puerto Rico, which is also in the Caribbean, despite the fact that it's in effect an American colony, but also in the Caribbean and being seriously impacted by these events, these sort of natural disasters. And now we have to consider what this means. Like in the aftermath of these very serious occurrences with Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Jose and Maria, what does it mean now for these island nation states in terms of how to prevent from or reduce the impact of these events in the future? Because climate change will continue. And it sort of gets to the heart of is why can't these nations do more for themselves to prevent against these events? And the reality is that most of, if not all of these nations, through colonialism and through neocolonialism, have been underdeveloped. They don't have the resources to necessarily protect against these disasters. They have had structural adjustment programs and IMF loans, contingency loans that have been placed upon them that have stifled their development in many ways. And the tourism industry is, in fact, the primary industry in the majority of these Caribbean nation states. And these natural disasters, in fact, they even harm that industry. If you have all these buildings destroyed, all these structures destroyed, then you're talking about people not coming to your country because there's nothing for them to do. They don't have these wonderful, I guess, resorts that cater to their every need. The appeal of sex and sand is not as attractive when buildings can't provide the kind of amenities that they're accustomed to. But it also shows a failing in the tourism industry in terms of how that plays a role in underdeveloping these Caribbean nation states as well, because they've become so reliant on the tourism industry that things like agriculture have suffered. So a more healthy setup may be, well, we develop our agriculture industry, we make sure that our people can eat, and if we have a tourism industry, our agricultural industry feeds into that. But what you have instead is these multinational corporations coming in, taking up land, and they import their own food. They underpay the people who work around the resorts, and you have a situation where the economy of these countries, of these island nation states, are not developed. So I think there are so many things that have come out of these recent hurricanes that really make us question why it is that these nation states remain tied to the global north in the way that they do, because it's not leading to any sort of real independence and self-determination for these countries, and especially for these people who are living there. And you saw with the relief efforts, you had the when the British came to say that they were helping, the first people that they were seeking to help were actually the tourists. So there were planes coming and they were taking Canadian tourists and American tourists and French tourists away before even helping those people. So it's really a wake-up call. It should be a wake-up call for, if not the leaders of these Caribbean nation states, then the people themselves.
Now, of course, Black folks in Canada are largely a Caribbean diaspora, and we assume that lots of efforts are underway in Toronto and other Canadian cities for the diaspora to do what it can.
That's right. And there has been a lot of rallying around the hurricane incidents that have happened over the last few weeks. And so there are a lot of people who are looking to see how they can help and how they can support. It's actually been quite encouraging to see the people from various Caribbean islands who are living in Canada come together and say, what can we do? We've heard that this happened to Barbuda. What can we do to help? Where can we send money? What do they need? How can we facilitate communication? Like, there have been a lot of coordination efforts to provide that kind of aid and support to those countries during this time. And even in the Caribbean itself, when you see Antigua, who Sister Island Barbuda experiences that devastation, and their prime minister ultimately offers $300,000 US to Dominica in their relief efforts. And you have Guyana, which is part of the Caribbean community, though on the South American mainland, who has offered land to Dominicans. You know, in Trinidad and Tobago, they've offered people a place to stay without a sort of no questions asked if they can find their way to Trinidad and Tobago. So seeing it happen in the Caribbean and seeing it happen in Canada itself has been very encouraging. And I think that, especially for us at the Caribbean Solidarity Network, we're hoping that it is an entry point to start talking about real collaborative organizing efforts means for the rest of the Caribbean when we're talking about social, political, and economic development. And so as sad as it is that a disaster like this has happened and it has taken these hurricanes taking place to bring people together, we're hoping that it'll be an entry point to talk about how we can truly move forward as Caribbean people and people of Caribbean descent.
Haiti was not hit hard this season by hurricanes, but last year it was devastated. And of course, Haiti has been victimized by man-made and imperialism-made disasters. Canada is a prime destination for Haitians.
Yes, it is a prime destination for Haitians. Canada has this image in the world and an image that they project as being very welcoming and based on and humanitarian ideals and principles and being peacemakers and the like. But the reality is that when it comes to Canada's relationship with Haiti, particularly in the 21st century, Canada has been largely complicit, if not responsible, for the social and economic conditions of Haiti today. If we go back to when Jean-Bertrand Aristide won the most recent, I would say legitimate, Haitian election back in 2000 and started pushing for policies that would lead to the social development of Haiti, things like raising the minimum wage. So when he was swept into power in 2001, Canada was part of a group of countries, including France and the United States, that were not happy with what Jean-Bertrand Aristide was doing. And ultimately, in 2003, they had a meeting in Canada, in Ottawa, in fact, in January 2003, where they were trying to figure out how they could deal with this Aristide problem, right? How they can get around this, how they can ensure that these multinational corporations could get back into Haiti and continue with the types of exploitation that they had been engaging in when he gave up power again in 95, 96. And so they were trying to figure out how can we get over this obstacle called Aristide. And in 2004, the United States has this operation, February 29, 2004, where they, along with France and Canada, decide they're going to remove Jean-Bertrand Aristide from Haiti. That rollback continued the underdevelopment of Haiti. So then by 2010, when the earthquake hits Haiti, that devastating earthquake in 2010, the country is in shambles. Their ability to recover from that was undermined by neoliberal policies that had essentially limited their capacity to provide the kind of assistance to people who were impacted by the earthquake. And further to that, you have an influx of NGOs and the Canadian government facilitating this of NGOs that essentially are an opportunity for people who are not Haitian to benefit from opportunities in Haiti. So you have jobs that Canadians are holding that are not going to Haitians. So Canada has played an active role in destroying so many key elements of Haitian development. And it led to a situation where you had Haitians, if they could find a way out of Haiti, they were going to leave. And Canada, in fact, soon after the quake, had suspended their temporary removals. So in the United States, there's the temporary protected status that they gave to Haitians following the earthquake. In Canada, that they suspended the removals of Haitians. So it's essentially the same sort of protection. What created this situation is Donald Trump says that he's going to remove this protection status of Haitians in the United States, or he's contemplating doing it. So Haitians immediately think to themselves, well, we should go to Canada, because earlier this year, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, said that Canada is a welcoming place for refugees and for people who have no other place to go, or words to that effect. And so based on that assumption, many Haitians thought to come to Canada as a place of refuge. But in fact, Canada had already removed their protection status for Haitian migrants trying to come to Canada. And that has been in effect since August of 2016 under the same Trudeau government. In other words, Haitians coming to Canada don't automatically have this protected status. They have to go through the same sort of processes as other asylum-seeking persons that wish to come to Canada. And that means that what you have now is a situation where Haitians from the United States who have come to Canada, who have come to the province of Quebec specifically, there's a huge backlog of these applications of people coming here. They could be here for weeks upon weeks waiting. And before they started coming, out of all the Haitians that apply for refugee status in Canada, 65% of them were turned away. So this idea that Canada is a safe place of refuge for Haitians coming from the United States is not true. And not to mention all the complications with the United States and Canada having an agreement that if a migrant is coming from a safe country, they have to be sent back. The right thing for the Canadian government to do would be to fast track or at least allow asylum to all of these Haitian migrants that are coming to Canada, given the role that Canada has played in Haiti for at least the last 14, 15 years.
Yes, lots of folks in the United States, because Canadians flocked to Cuba when the United States had its harshest embargo on, imagined that Canada was somehow a progressive beacon in the Western Hemisphere, but not so, especially regarding Haiti, where it was the fountainhead of the scheme to steal Haiti's sovereignty.
Absolutely. Haiti is the best contemporary example of the truly insidious imperialist nature of the Canadian government. If people were to pay close attention to the activities of the Canadian government in Haiti, they couldn't be anything else but disgusted. In the aftermath of the earthquake, the world saw the thousands of troops that were sent to Haiti, and Canada had sent over 2,000 of their own troops. They were the second largest force alongside the United States. And when you look at, you know, the millions of dollars in aid, and we hear billions of dollars in aid that goes to Haiti, a mere fraction of that money actually goes to Haitian people. And the Canadian government is aware of this, and they continue to participate in it. So all of these generous or sincere or bastion of human rights principles is really just a cover for a sort of little brother of the United States, so to speak, in terms of the way they very much participate in the same imperialist policies in their own backyard.
People in the United States certainly used to call Canada the Great White North. Canada's not as white as it used to be, but politically, you seem to be saying it's acting still like the Great White North.
Oh, absolutely. It absolutely is acting like the Great White North. And you're right to say that there are more racialized people coming from the Global South who are living in Canada and living in cities like in Toronto, where I currently live. Nearly half the population of Toronto, if not more, are people of color. And yet still, you have these same policies persist, these same ideas persist. When we look at the politicians, many of them aren't people of color, but even the ones that are, when we look at our major parties, they all represent capitalist interests. They all represent ideas that are in a lot of ways anti-people ideas. We recently had someone whose family is from India and religiously is a Sikh, who was elected as the leader of the New Democratic Party, which is considered to be a left party in Canada. And so there are many who feel encouraged by this, because you now have a person of color who's the head of a major political party. But when you look at the ideas of the party itself, yes, they aren't as pro-capitalist as the Liberal and the Conservative Party, but in a lot of ways, they don't represent a fundamental change in the structure of economic policy or social policy in Canada. And so it does not bode well for people of color living in Canada, despite the hoopla and the excitement around the first ever person of color who is the head of a major political party in Canada.
That was Renato Gregg of the Caribbean Solidarity Network speaking from Toronto, Canada.
It's been 100 years since the Russian Revolution changed the history of the world. Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, was part of a celebration of the past century of struggle for scientific socialism. Dr. Horn discussed the seminal work of historian Philip S. Foner, author of the book The Bolshevik Revolution and Its Impact on American Radicals, Liberals, and Labor.
Philip S. Foner was probably the preeminent Marxist U.S. historian of the 20th century. I guess his only competition would be Herbert Aptheker, the late Herbert Aptheker. Of course, Philip Foner has passed from the land of the living as well. He was of Eastern European Jewish descent. He was part of a prominent family of scholars and activists. His brother Jack was a historian of Black Americans and Black soldiers, and Jack's son, Eric Foner, is considered to be a leading historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And then, of course, there was Henry Foner, who was a leader, a trade union leader, and Mo Foner, who was also a trade union leader. Philip Foner was sacked, perhaps illegally, from the City College of New York in Harlem in the early 1940s as part of an anti-communist purge. He wound up teaching at the historically Black Lincoln University outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. He taught there for a number of years. The Cold War context is that the hysteria that gripped the United States in the period from, let us say, 1917 to 1991, when the Soviet Union collapses, when the United States turned all of its energy to destabilizing the Soviet Union, spending trillions of dollars on Pentagon spending, even cutting deals with religious zealots in Afghanistan in order to weaken the Soviet Union, which had intervened in Afghanistan in 1979 on behalf of a left-leaning government. As you know, that backfired spectacularly on September 11, 2001, when these alleged former allies then attacked Washington and has ensnared the United States in a war that's continuing to this very day, not to mention spinoff wars that are taking place throughout that region. And perhaps the most spectacular own goal, as they say in London, that the United States was involved in was the deal it cut with China to try to undermine the Soviet Union. This was seen as a brilliant stroke by Richard M. Nixon some four odd decades ago when he went to China. But I dare say that sooner rather than later, given the fact that China has turned into this juggernaut, that brilliant stroke won't be seen as brilliant sooner rather than later. In any event, that's the Cold War context that gave rise to this book, where Foner was intentionally trying to intervene in the anti-communist discourse, trying to revive and resuscitate a history that had been forgotten, because as the book suggests, surprisingly enough to certain U.S. audiences, there was significant sentiment in favor of the Bolshevik Revolution and its immediate aftermath. And it took a lot of pushing and poisoning by U.S. imperialism to help to alter that positive attitude.
You know, one of the things that struck me when reading the book was how many unions and how many religious people and even some bankers and businessmen praised the emergence of the Soviet Union and saw it as a great step forward for humankind. Were there particular things about the book for you that stand out the most? And also, why is it important for us today to care about what liberals, labor leaders, and radicals thought about the Soviet Union in 1919 to 1921? And how is that connected to the struggle for what some folks have referred to as scientific socialism?
Well, the late writer Gore Vidal once suggested that the USA stands for the United States of Amnesia. There's widespread ignorance about history in this country, and many of our liberal, labor, and radical friends are not even aware of the history of their own ideological tendencies. And so it's very important for this kind of history to be revived, to be brought to their attention, because it may lead to their rethinking some of their fundamental concepts, because, as you know, given the strength of Trumpery as we speak, the fact that this con man got 63 million votes, that suggests the formidable task that's ahead of us, which also suggests that we cannot do this by ourselves. We'll need liberal friends, allies, labor friends, allies, all manner of friends and allies.
Dr. Gerald Horn on the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, are worried about the recent conduct of Judge Leon Tucker. The Pennsylvania judge had earlier demanded that the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office provide all of its files on Abu-Jamal's case, so he could determine if the DA had shown a bias towards his political allies in the Fraternal Order of Police. However, last month, Judge Tucker appeared to ease up on his pressure on the DA's office. Sophia Williams of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home is worried.
We're really in this lingering state where Mumia's life still hangs in the balance, and his freedom essentially has always been on the line, but this is a moment where we truly have something tangible in which we can get back into the courtroom and demand his freedom as we've never done before. And essentially, we don't know when anything will happen, because, again, there's no updates that are coming in, and we really don't know which direction the judge will turn in, as transparency is really important here, and so far, that's not something that Mumia's attorneys and Mumia himself is being granted.
And on that point of transparency and where the judge might be leaning, wasn't there a change to Judge Tucker's early September order, an unexpected change wherein the language changed from just a request for the files, generally speaking, to a more specific set of files that the defense was in fact already privy to?
Yes, that change was that he essentially asked for the publicly available files. Essentially, that's what his language came down to, which is a bit odd because he has asked for all the files prior, and when they gave him public files, he denied that and said that's not what he requested. And he made it his duty to hammer them for what he requested, but now he's changing his original request.
So just as kind of a general timeline here, in April, the request for discovery was made. That request was granted. The DA's office cynically replied by providing only publicly available files, which clearly weren't the files that were being requested. Judge Tucker goes on to demand that the files be released in general, all of the files, and then Judge Tucker alters his request to request essentially the same publicly available files or other publicly available files, much like the problematic files that were released by the DA's office initially. Is that more or less the timeline?
Yes, that's exactly what that is. Yes.
So in your view, and recognizing that this is an ongoing legal issue, but just from your standpoint, what could explain Judge Tucker's sudden reversal or alteration that leaves out the files that are most needed in this case?
I really do think that something is up, something serious is up, and I don't know what exactly it could be. I don't think none of us know exactly what that could be, but I truly feel something's up, and it could be a matter of, you know, something being said to the judge that has caused him, like something behind the scenes have been said that has caused him to make this drastic and one could almost say outrageous change that makes no complete sense. And one could also think that because the city of Philadelphia is about to embark on a new district attorney coming into office sometime in November, and it's looking to be the Democratic candidate, Larry Krasner, who has made it his campaign's duty to fight for justice and overhaul the wrongs of the justice system in Pennsylvania. I just have to believe with that about to probably he's likely to take office, and with whatever else could be said from the DA's office to the judge's office, something there is happening. And it's not looking good, but it's also not looking all that horrible. But it's one of those things where Mumia's life hangs in the balance, and there's no game to be played in these crucial, high-staking moments.
And given the magnitude of Mumia's case and the decades-long struggle for his freedom and all of the manipulation on the part of the FOP and various other entities trying to ensure Mumia's death, these kinds of hijinks are nothing new as regards this struggle.
Exactly, nothing new.
Now, the campaign to bring Mumia home has been quite active in the city outside of the ongoing struggle for Mumia's freedom. Could you speak briefly about some of those recent actions?
We recently took part in a protest by Trump Tower on Tuesday, actually. And it was a protest for Puerto Rico, not only regarding the fact that they have been literally treated as second-class citizens and practically ignored during their humanitarian crisis, but we demanded the United States out of Puerto Rico. And that was what we demanded that evening. And it was a spirited event. Members of the campaign to bring Mumia home was there. And so, of course, Mumia's spirit is there, and Mumia is always in solidarity with the citizens of Puerto Rico, but everyone else was there, and it was just a beautiful moment in which people chanted and played music and spoke for Puerto Ricans in their crisis at this moment, but also in their larger historical crisis of being under the feet of the United States and that economic burden that it has brought. And now in their crisis, they cannot seem to get the proper help they need. And one of the main things that we were demanding is an end to the Jones Act. Not a temporary lift, which has been given and is almost up, but a complete end to an act that has made things harder for them and makes no sense.
As for the coming months, what does the campaign to bring Mumia home have scheduled?
One of our main focus right now is to have a premiere for our project called Inside the Activist Studio, in which we interviewed longstanding revolutionary Ramona Africas of the MOVE organization. So we are looking to have that premiere very, very soon, and we'll have it here in New York City. Another thing that we have brewing in the works is a book party. For those that do not know, Mumia recently released a book called Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? So we do have a book party in mind to be had sometime, hopefully before the year is out. And so as we have more details fleshed out on that, we surely will pass that on. And On December 8th and December 9th, as many people may know, December 9th was the initial moment where they arrested and started to frame Mumia. So every year we put something on to commemorate Mumia's life. The fact is that he's still with us and we're fighting for him to continue to be with us. And so on December 8th in Philadelphia, there will be a number of teach-ins, or there will be a teach-in on a number of different topics. And the next day, December 9th, Saturday, December 9th, we will be having a march starting at the Rizzo statue. And so as more details again come forth around these two huge and important days, we definitely will have an update to our listeners.
And where can people find you or contact about further information regarding these actions?
They can email the campaign to bring Mumia home. So that's bringmumiahome@gmail.com. They can also check out bringmumiahome.com, which is our website that will have more information. We are definitely still out there in the streets demanding that Mumia is freed and that he is with those that love him and in a safe place. And we will not stop fighting for his freedom.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.